This is the Stick and Hack Show. Conversation, discussion, debate, and golf talk from a stick, Mike Ryan, and the hack, Adam Grubb. Boys, you are up.
All right, welcome in. This is the Stick and Hack Show, the most sophisticated golf show in the free world. I am your host, Adam Grubb. The hack, that's Stick right there. Mike Ryan. Stick, how are you?
I am wonderful.
All right, so here's the thing. We're in our winter studio now. This is the brand new Stick and Hack Winter Studio, and we thank Allies for letting us be here and doing this thing. This just feels Stick and Hack-esque, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And obviously, we've kind of upgraded the bar in the back
slightly.
And from my understanding, we can't. It's not free. Our bill is already $87. We've been here 1 hour setting up. All right. So first up, we've got a guest on this show that we're very excited about. It's a very very unique job title that he has. Craig Haltom joins the Stick and Hack Show here in just a bit. He's a golf course designer and he's an architect and manages golf courses in the Midwest. He has a couple different companies. We're going to talk to him a little bit about the golf design, what that means, as well as just the job itself, because it's one of those jobs that you don't even think about when you're playing a course. There are several key architects and designers that get all the love and get all the publicity. But there's courses all across the country and the world that are very unique in their setting, very unique in their play, and they're designed by somebody who sees a piece of land and says, this can be a golf course.
Yeah.
And I know this is a topic that you're very excited about.
I am. I'm really excited. It's going to be a good interview.
All right. So first up, there was an anonymous pro survey from golf.com, which whatever you feel about anonymous surveys, these are the results. You know, I mean, I guess at any point,
I love this. I read this before. And it's
at any point, you could just survey people anonymously and then just make up the stats. Right. You could just say, we surveyed. But sure. Apparently this is they survey the pro golfers every year. And these are their answers. So I want to hear your thoughts. OK, so this anonymous pro survey from golf.com. 28% of professional golfers said they witnessed a player knowingly break a rule and get away with it last season.
Yep.
Now that second part is what is exciting to me, that they got away with it. So this goes back to everything we've ever talked about.
I think the real number is probably higher.
You're probably right.
Yeah.
So they knowingly saw a player break a rule and then they got away with it. And then what? I mean, nothing.
Nothing.
What if somebody like won major money? 28%.
We'll never know because it's anonymous.
I guess you're right. It's the entire point of it. 90% of those polled said they'd beat Tiger Woods in a 36-hole match tomorrow. That is the best.
That's delusional.
Well, what I the don't hell care. Are they going to say?
That's delusional.
90%. Now, 36 holes. Maybe that's because they're looking at Tiger at his age and his health
delusional.
And all that stuff.
That's delusional.
Would beat him. 90%. So you got 10% of those people that we've never heard of that are in, maybe making cuts here and there who are like, no chance, Chief. I'm not going to be able to beat him. But 90% of tour players say they could beat Tiger Woods.
Again, anonymous. Therefore, they'll never have
to. Right. They don't have to, back that up.
Yeah.
All right. So then the third question, who is the most famous person in your phone? Now, a normal person, the most famous person in my phone is you.
I was going to say the same thing.
Oh, yes. Look at us. This is our first connection, finally, in 10 episodes.
It's really a sad statistic for both of us.
Yeah. Right. Well, who's the best person on your phone? Well, my co-host. So they're the most famous person in the phone, six players named Michael Jordan as the most famous. And that's a tall order.
That'd be like bucket list for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Just to have him in your phone.
Have him in my phone. Would be.
Would you?
List.
I bet you'd text me in the middle of the night. You up?
I would. I would. Yo, MJ.
You
what's
up?
Happening? He was actually, he was in town last week.
In Indianapolis?
He was.
Why? You lose a bet?
Dwight Freeney was getting inducted into the Ring of Fame.
That's right.
And he was at his reception the night before.
Yeah. Peyton and Jordan and everybody.
Yeah. I saw a picture on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah. Michael Jordan was the most famous person on their phone. Again, an anonymous pro survey from golf.com. 20% or one in five pros said they have either smoked pot or ingested edibles in the last year. Additionally, more than half of them said marijuana should be removed from the tour's banned substance list.
I believe that. There's, I think it's high. I think 20% is low.
Yeah, there's nothing nothing shocking about that.
No,
at all. 20% has smoked pot or ingested edibles in the last year. That is probably low. And even though it's anonymous, that's still something that you can't maybe bring yourself to say, yeah, I've done that. And now somebody just got banned from the PGA, suspended for the PGA for marijuana.
Who?
Is that really the question you're going to
you
ask
me? You don't research these things?
Chester. I have no idea. Chester Smith? I have no idea.
I don't know.
All I know is that he was banned. There was some guy.
I know there was a guy in the NBA that just got.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
It might be. It probably is.
It might not even be a golfer.
It probably is. Dion Waiters.
Dion Waiters.
Yeah, he ate an edible on the team plane and freaked out. So they suspended him.
That's the best. all right, so anonymous pro survey at golf.com. When asked who their least favorite playing partner was, 26% said anyone who plays slowly, but the most common answers were Rory Sabatini, who I didn't realize was still alive, let alone playing golf, and your friend, Bryson DeChambeau.
Yeah.
And that was 100% said.
Neither of those surprised me.
So Rory is jerk, isn't he?
He's notoriously just kind of a dick.
Yeah, and Bryson is just super slow and weird, right?
Yes.
The scientist.
Yes, and he wears a weird hat.
All right, so 26% said anyone who plays slowly. Again, I think that's low as well. Don't you?
Yeah, I do.
All right, so that's the anonymous pro survey from golf.com. What would be a question that you would want on that survey if you were putting it on there? What would you want to know from them that is anonymous for all time? There's got to be something that you would ask them.
How many times have you played drunk?
Oh, yeah.
That'd be one I'd like to know.
There's a bunch of those stories of people that either drunk or hungover and had, like, incredible rounds. I mean, that's something that a hack can rely
on. Well, we just featured a story about that on our daily email.
Oh, yeah.
About MJ.
Yeah, the early tea.
Yeah.
Yeah, Michael. Oh, that's right. Michael Jordan was drinking most of the day.
Yeah.
And then went to and played against who was it?
He bet Jeremy Roenick.
Jeremy Roenick. Yeah.
Yeah.
Michael Jordan. This is Michael Jordan Day here on the Stick and Hack Show. Apparently,
it is.
He bet Jeremy Roenick in 36 holes, lost thousands of dollars, and they drank most of the day. And then he went to a game that night. This is 1994.
And he bet him he would score over 40 points and that they would win by more than 20.
Right.
And he scored 52 and they won by 26. that's why he's the GOAT.
That's right. Indeed. All right. President's Cup is coming up here in a couple weeks. And the President's Cup is the poor man's Ryder Cup. Now, for those that don't know the President's Cup, the world in 1994... the world got together and said, hey, you guys have been doing this Ryder Cup thing, which looks like a lot of fun. You haven't invited anybody other than
Europeans
and the U.S. We'd like to have a thing as well. And the U.S. said, sure, that sounds great. We'll just do it every year. We don't do the Ryder Cup. And thus, the President's Cup was born. It is, in fact, the USA versus the world.
Correct.
Correct? Minus the Europeans.
Minus the Europeans, yeah.
Why is it different than the Ryder Cup? Why doesn't it get as much love as the Ryder Cup? And why do people not get as excited about it as they probably should? Except for Tiger picking himself as the captain, which I think is just the best move ever.
Yeah, I think it's just because there's not as much history there. That's honestly what I think. There's just not the history. The Ryder Cup goes back so far, and there's so much more history there with it.
It doesn't have the same intensity either.
It doesn't, and I think some of it has to do with
Ian Poulter.
Ian always helps. I mean, you know, Patrick Reed.
Yeah.
I mean, he's going to be in this one, but there's just not as many rivalries there, I don't think. There's not as many personalities. I feel like the European team always has more personalities, mainly because there's Scottish guys.
Right. I couldn't. I don't
cool
know.
Cool accents.
Here's the only time I know where somebody is from.
Yeah.
And if they're European or not is during these events.
Right.
Because to me, if they're Australian, they're European. I know that's dumb and small-minded, but that's how I don't know where these people are from until the President's Cup,
right? Yeah,
or the Ryder Cup. Right. So, is it ever going to be the Ryder Cup?
No, I don't think it will be. It'll always kind of be this. It'll be the stepchild, I guess.
So the Ryder Cup is every even year, right? So it'll be the Ryder Cup will be next year. Is it every 2 years?
Ryder Cup is next year, I believe.
Right. So Ryder Cup is every 2 years, and President's Cup is every 2 years, and they
kind of flip-flop.
So USA has this team thing every single year, basically.
All right.
So President's Cup is in Melbourne, Australia this year. Next year, it's in North Carolina here in – or not next year. 2021,
yeah,
it's going to be North Carolina here in the States, which would be fun to get to. Did you get Ryder Cup tickets?
No.
No, neither did I. I was in line.
I remember.
It was a nightmare.
Yeah.
I was in line for an hour and a half, not a virtual line, which is actually worse, quite frankly, because you have to continually make sure your browser doesn't go to sleep. So I'm in line for an hour and a half, and then they say, hey, congratulations. Yeah. You're up for tickets. And I said, oh, great. And so I start to click things, and everything was sold out.
Sold out.
Well, why are you letting me at the counter?
They haven't figured that out.
It was a disaster.
Yeah.
So I'm not going. But in case any Stick and Hack listeners would like for Stick and Hack to go.
Or gift us.
Gift us.
I'm in.
No, we'll go with you, or you can just gift us the tickets.
Yeah.
Right?
All
right. So that's that. Let's bring in our guest now, Craig Haltom. He's a golf course designer, developer, and construction manager for golf courses around the Midwest and parts of the United States. Craig, welcome in.
Hi, guys.
Hey, so you're, I got you. So you are in an excavator, it appears, or a closet, or where are you right now?
I'm in an excavator.
All right, so are you literally building a golf course as we speak?
I'm literally building a par 3 course in Wisconsin Dells, and...
That's awesome.
In a race against the snow, I'm in Wisconsin, so well, we're trying to get as much done as we can.
Well, this is
we're frozen.
This is perfect timing then for you to take an hour out of your day to talk to us. So thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for letting me do it from this machine.
Yeah, no problem. Sorry, as a golf designer, your job is literally that. You design golf courses, which we sometimes, Mike and I talked about at the top of the show, we forget that there's somebody that has a mind and a vision behind the courses. So tell me a little bit about how you got into this, where this passion for golf and golf course design came from.
Well, I got interested in golf. My mom got me started just playing a few holes with her when I was probably 12 or 13. And then my dad moved to Valparaiso, Indiana for his job. And, we had grown up in Indianapolis. I moved up there and just was very fortunate to find some friends on the high school golf team that were really into golf, really good golfers, guys that went on to play real college golf. And because I got to know them, and I wasn't very good at the time, not that I've ever gotten that good, but I was really not very good at that time. But these guys, helped me get better and they taught me how to take golf seriously. So as a golfer, I really got into it in my high school years. And I was always artistic, that was my thing. And I, in my head, I thought, it sounds like a pretty interesting job to kind of go create these golf courses. And at the time, this was a long time ago. This was the 90s when it didn't seem crazy that you might build golf courses as a job, because there were so many getting built at the time.
Right.
There were hundreds of golf courses getting built in the U.S. at the time. That's all changed now. So I just decided that I would try to pursue that. And there's no straight line to it. It's a very strange job.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot of fun, but what I did was I in undergraduate, so the typical degree or study that you would do for golf course design would be landscape architecture.
Right.
And they didn't have that at the little college that they let me play golf at, which is why I went. Yeah. was not heavily recruited. Right. But I got to.
Did they even know you were on the team, Craig? Did they have any idea you were even on the team?
Well, thanks, Adam. Yeah, they did know I was on the team. And if you really want to hear about it, I might have been the number one man on the Manchester College.
Oh, there you go, Craig.
There we go.
Powerhouse.
Yeah.
Powerhouse.
There it is.
I like it.
We actually sometimes had to pick up the fifth guy and explain to him that he had to count all the shots on the way to the tournament.
They
hand him over to the guys he was playing with.
No picking up.
Yeah, they you can't just stop. You can't say, hey, I'm in my pocket.
That's right.
I'm out of the hole. All right, so one of your recent claims to fame is Sand Valley. And Sand Valley is up in Wisconsin, which is where you currently live and manage a lot of those courses up there. But Sand Valley is and if I have this correct, was constructed and partly designed by the same guys that did Bandon Dunes out in Oregon. And this, but you were the kind of the predecessor there of that land. You found it, you discovered it, and you said to yourself, this is going to be an incredible course. And there's multiple courses there. You just bought it. You just built a new one up there in Sand Valley. But it is this resort style course that's in the middle of Wisconsin, the middle of nowhere, and is doing very, very well. It's incredible. It's walk, it's caddies, it's the way golf should be played. And it's an incredible piece of land and property. Tell me the story behind Sand Valley and how you found that, that land.
Well, to fast forward from what I was just telling you, I went to college in Indiana and then got married to my wife, Becky, and we both moved over to Scotland where we lived for 3 years.
Nice.
And I went to school there in landscape architecture and went there to see, you know, the world's best golf courses. And that's what we did. And it was great. And part of that time over there, I met a young man at the time. I think he was probably 22 years old, Greg Ramsey, who was a bartender at the old course in St. Andrews.
Nice.
Just a remarkable guy. And it's, you know, he remains a friend and we work with him, and he's just a really neat guy. But at that time he was upselling whiskey to Japanese tourists in the old course hotel. And, you know, you could tell right away he's a really dynamic guy. And he had this plan to go back to Tasmania, and develop a golf course in perfect Lynx land. And he went and did it. He went back, convinced a landowner to develop this property as golf. And where I'm going with this is part of that process was, Mike Kaiser, who owns and developed Bandon Dunes in Oregon, was an investor and also someone who encouraged that landowner in Tasmania that, yeah, you could do this. You could have a really nice family business.
Right.
And no, this young man is not crazy. You really do have a spectacular property. So Mike was a big part of getting that project started. And, you know, fast forwarding to when Becky and I moved back, we had to pick somewhere to live. We moved to Wisconsin because she was a botanist and had reason to go to the University of Wisconsin. So we ended up in Wisconsin. And when we got here, you know, I was primed from living in Scotland and seeing all these beautiful Lynx courses.
Yeah.
And also had just spent a lot of time with Greg and hearing him say how he had gone, you know, and found this land and it was happening. There's no doubt I was influenced by that. So what I did was just start looking for a spectacular property in Wisconsin. Because what I found out when I moved to Wisconsin, I didn't know anything about Wisconsin.
Right.
But when we moved here, I realized that it was there's a gigantic vein of sand that runs through the center of the state, which is left over from the glaciers. It used to be a big lake. So that sand was a lake bed. And over, you know, once the glaciers melted, that sand then blew around in the center part of the state. And, you know, in much of the state, it's dead flat. But there are spots where that sand then blew into giant sand dunes. So I started what now seems insane. You know, I don't know why I was doing it or why I was so obsessed by it, but I really, really was deliberate in going around Wisconsin and trying to find what I thought would be the best golf course site. And that went on for 4 or 5 years. And I'm not exaggerating to say that it was a complete obsession. And my wife, you know, thankfully, went along with it. And we would plan trips to go hiking in these interesting areas that I thought were good for golf. And then that search eventually led to the property at Sand Valley. And once I saw that, I thought, well, this is it. You can't do it here. You know, it's just not going to happen.
Right.
And then went from trying to find the land to trying to develop it. And, I convinced my boss at the time or the land convinced him, put an option on the land and try to keep the ball in the air and see if we could develop it. That was 2009. So it's going way back. And that search that I'm talking about started in 2001. So, I mean, this is a long period of time.
And Sand Valley opened when did Sand Valley open? 2015?
Yeah, open, but construction started, you know, we were building courses in 2013. And like you said, now there's two courses, a par three, and we're going on the third course. So it's nice. Just been it's going as fast as you could possibly go.
That's awesome.
But once we found the land, where this is all going is tried to develop it. It was 2009. You can imagine there wasn't a lot of appetite for golf course development at that time.
There wasn't an appetite for anything in 2009. That was, everything sucked.
Yeah.
we had projects that literally went from, you know, giant residential golf course projects to overnight people ripping wire out of the ground and just, you know, what seemed like the end of the world at the time. But our work, you know, completely disappeared. You know, there's nobody was building golf courses. But anyway, so where this is going with Greg is that it wasn't happening, and Greg reached out and said, "Hey, how's your project going?" Because I had talked to him a lot and had shared some things with him. I said, "Hey, Greg, I don't think it's going to happen. So why don't you come with me to meet Mike in Chicago? I'm coming over to the States, and I'll bring you up there, and you can meet Mike Kaiser, and we'll see how it goes." So that's what we did. Greg introduced me to Mike, who he knew through Barnburgle Dunes, and showed Mike, went up there with all of our photos and all of that. And Mike, you know, just immediately said, I only do golf courses on oceans. And at that point, apart from his own course, a 9-hole course, a very cool course in Michigan, the Dunes Club, he had always built, these courses on Lynx Land on the ocean. And there's no ocean in Wisconsin.
Wait, what?
So
wait, what? What?
Yeah.
Huh.
So you didn't do any research on Wisconsin. You were joking. You didn't know what the hell you were getting involved in.
Yeah, it was a surprise to me too. But he was certain that there was no ocean in Wisconsin. But so he said no. But then he's a nice person, so he was nice enough to send Josh Lesnick from Kemper Sports to come out and meet me and walk around. And Josh went back to Mike and said, "Well, it's pretty neat. You should probably go look at it."
Yeah.
And then Mike and his sons came and visited, and I might even get the year wrong, but I think that was 2012, the fall of 2012. I'm getting my years confused. But
it's all right. You're an excavator. It's okay. We will forgive you on the dates.
Yeah. Thank you. And then somewhere along the line, it turned into a yes, and they decided to do it. And from that point on, it's gone as fast as it could. And it's been obviously the highlight of my professional career. And it's just been fantastic. And working with the Kaisers,
those are huge names in the golf design and in golf community. That's a name that anybody that enjoys golf and sees a course for what it is, that's a name that they know. Just like Pete Dye, any of those other guys that are just iconic in this space, he is one of them. And so it was probably fortuitous in many ways that you guys connected and Sand Valley was born. There's a vision, though, that you have to have. I mean, you went through 15 years there of time from the idea of a course to it being built. Is it typically like that, or what is the vision? How does that come to your mind when you see a piece of land? And not just the process, but when do you say in your head, okay, this is hole 7, this is going to be the 18th here, this is how this looks? How do you do that?
Well, I think that is a long timeline, but these are big projects, and that can be fairly typical, whether it's a golf course or any type of big development. These things take a long time. In the case of these courses in Wisconsin, we weren't facing any great regulatory or permitting hurdles, which can really slow down projects for golf. If you're trying to develop a golf course in California, or, you know, the fact that Mike was able to build Bandon Dunes in Oregon, that was, you know, those are not easy things to do. And it's a credit to them and the way they do things that they were, you know, that they're able to do it. But the timelines can be really long, and it can be infinitely long if there's endangered species and things like that. So, but to answer your question about when do you start thinking about golf holes? I mean, in my case, that was all I was doing. You know, I was going to see all of these different properties, and, you know, you just never shut that off. And for me, trying to paint a vision for people coming out there, you know, you don't have to tell Mike Kaiser, "Hey, this could be a great golf course." He's done it, and he's walking through trees and scrubby pine or scrubby sand and all that. but you know, they know instantly that it's a neat property. If you're out there with someone who doesn't do that or hasn't had that exposure or experience, it can be very difficult to say, look at this. This is going to be a great par right. five or right. whatever.
I think you're talking about me. Yeah, you're talking about me, Craig.
Yeah. That guy.
Yeah.
Well, so like I am calling you from an excavator and I'm staring at a pile of dirt. And, you know, if I was telling you what this was, you'd say, yeah, okay. Call me when it's done because I'm not seeing it.
call me when there's a tea time available and not a minute before then.
Craig, how much?
Yeah.
How often do you, so when you look at kind of on the same vein, when you look at a piece of land, do you try and take the natural features of the land and just, that's where you visualize and see a hole? Or is it more of, it may be a piece of land, but you know, there are three or four things that you need to do to make it into the hole that you want.
Well, the best golf courses are the ones that are built using every available natural feature.
Right.
The main reason is that you won't do as good a job replicating those things, you know, with a bulldozer as what might be there naturally. It's a difficult thing to do.
Yeah.
So you'd be wise to use what you have. Yeah. On top of that, it's easier construction and
right.
it's just a better way to do things. But there are spots, you know, what the process, you know, can look like is you might recognize some things immediately, some spots that you think must be in the routing that there's some, right. you know, some features that are unique or interesting enough that you say, okay, these are the things that are going to anchor this routing. And I really want to get back to these points. And I think one thing that a lot of, even people that are interested in architecture, or just golfers probably don't realize is how much of a give and take there is on all of those decisions.
Right.
You know,
exactly.
You really have to,
you
might think that this golf course has to make it back to this one spot because there's all these great things, but then there will be complicating factors or some decisions to make one or two holes ahead that make that less likely to work.
Yeah.
So a lot of times you end up editing yourself and your first ideas. And what I've learned is, you know, the time spent editing yourself, you know, putting something on paper, walking away from it, coming back after a day and looking at it with fresh eyes usually yields, you know, some good ideas. So you're always looking and refining.
Yeah.
But you know, for me, you know, I, like I said, I'm kind of an artistic person, a very visual person. Yeah. So, you know, I can lock in pretty quickly on what I think the thing might look like.
Right.
Craig, do you think there are rules that can be broken in golf course design? So there's these unwritten rules in golf courses that you can't have an 18th hole over as a par three. You can't you have to have an easy first hole. These things that kind of and gimmicky holes within design. Are there rules that can be broken and should be broken and we should stop doing in golf course design?
No, I mean, the easiest answer is there literally are no rules, and the best golf courses would break any rules that you might propose as being kind of standard. So when you look at all the golf courses that have really stood out over time, most of them have some unconventional, the best example in the world is the Old Course, which was, if you want to call it designed by, refined by Old Tom, you know, many, many, many years ago, but was essentially, evolved from what was naturally there and people were playing golf on it and literally no rules at that time, including the number of holes and all of that. So if you go back to the very foundations of golf design, it was more about a journey through a landscape and not so much about any regimented rules. What's happened, of course, when you start building housing and get serious about planning things is that some things become convention and more standard.
Yeah.
But the really neat thing that's happened over the past 20 years as a result of, you know, these remarkable modern architects like Ben Crenshaw and Bill Corr and Tom Doak and many others, they have reinforced the idea that there's really no rules in golf architecture.
Yeah.
They're not concerned about par. They're not chasing any type of yardage or anything like that. They're really just building the best golf course that presents itself.
Right.
On the ground.
That's great.
And that's been hugely influential. And I think that's, you know, there's less golf projects going on, and the ones that are thankfully more often than not following that model of, breaking out of any, you know, convention.
Yeah. What, Craig, what's your favorite course you didn't design?
Well, the one I just mentioned, the Old Course, which is probably a bit of a cliche answer, but there's a reason that so many golf architects or so many, you know, just people that have traveled and played enough golf always come back to the Old Course. It's so strange and so unique. It's like, you know, I've heard it described as a rumpled sea or ocean that's just been frozen on the ground, and that's what it's like when you're walking it. There's these wild contours in the greens, and there's double greens, and there's all the bunkers have a history, and there's just so much that goes into it. But the golf itself is really remarkable, probably because of the things I was just talking about. It breaks convention in so many ways, and it's just uniquely one of a kind.
Yeah.
And you said that when you were younger, you always had this artistic feeling and thought, and then you got into golf, and then all of a sudden you woke up one day and you're a golf course architect and designer. If a kid is grows up on a course, loves golf, loves art, loves design, loves those things, what is the best way for them to start in this job? And you said yourself that it's very strange. So if I was eight and my 8-year-old buddy was like, hey, I want to design golf courses, I would have some questions for him, I think. You know what I mean? I'd be like, hey, maybe hang out with your parents a little bit more. Maybe find some new friends. But if a kid is wanting to do that, where do they start?
Well, you should play golf. That's a good place to start.
Right.
There are some unique examples of famous golf architects that didn't play golf, but I wouldn't use that as a model. I think it's a good idea to probably play golf.
Absolutely.
So you'd have to, you know, if you're going to do this for a living, you don't have to play well, but you really want to know golf and you want to be immersed in it. And that starts with playing. So I would tell that 8-year-old to play golf and see if they like it. What I say to young, and I get asked quite a bit from young guys, cause it is an interesting thing to do, obviously. Right. And, but there's no, I can only speak from my own experience. There's no straight line to doing this. And, for me, I just thought I would try to learn as much as I could about building golf courses and you know, literally just get into the construction of courses and hopefully, you know, over time opportunities to present myself where I could have a stronger voice in design. And now, thankfully, you know, I'm employed doing this and it's great. But as a young person, you know, that means it can be a long road, and you got to start literally in the trench. And the more you can learn about all parts of building a golf course and maintaining a golf course, I mean, that's also another thing. One entry point, a very good entry point for people that are interested in golf architecture, is golf course maintenance.
Yeah.
So I steer a lot of young guys that way to say, look, just make sure, first of all, you like working outside. Because you're going to be outside all the time, and wear sunscreen. But you know, and guys sort themselves out that way. I mean, the short answer is you really have to want it, because, you know, the opportunities are rare, and I wouldn't discourage anyone from pursuing anything, really, but just know that there's probably no shortcuts, and you just gotta get in there and learn how to do it.
Do you see that in the development phase as being the most challenging part of it, in the actual working with municipalities and working with the finance and all that, or is it finding the land and then finding a course that people are going to want to play and want to be a part of and enjoy and experience?
Well, both are very important and usually involve very different, you know, people. And there's, you know, obviously you can't start a project without some vision of what it can be. And the very best projects that, you know, are starting with an incredible property that, that follows some path, like what I described for Sand Valley, where there's some crazy person, you know, who's just determined
roaming,
that this thing is going to be a golf course.
Roaming the middle of Wisconsin for 10 years.
Yes.
Honey, this is, this looks like it could be a course. No, but come on, bub. Let's just keep, let's keep walking, please. Get the dog and let's go on. Yeah. Where the hell's the dog at? Well, he's,
so,
go ahead.
But I mean, that's not always the, that's not always the process, but it helps if someone is, you know, is determined and pushing the thing through, because there are a lot of hurdles. The, but to answer your question, you know, you, once you found this property, you know, the difference between a great golf course and, you know, a good golf course, but something that wasn't quite as good as it probably should have been, or however you want to say that, is determined by the people that are working on the ground building the course, and the architect's vision, and all the people that you would describe as real artists. You know, I'm sitting in an excavator, but this is, you know, the people that are doing this on golf courses and building bunkers and doing the cool features and shaping greens and all that, these people, they're all artists. And, you know, it's a creative thing that, you know, the very best architects working these days obviously put things on paper. And, but the real work happens in the field, and you're making changes all the time. And that's hopefully, you know, if you, when you work that way, it, it leads to a better result, and it's something that really fits. I've been lucky to be able to work that way myself.
Right.
I've, you know, I could go through the list of projects, but I really, it's so, you know, I've been extremely fortunate to be given jobs where with obviously owner input, but given a free hand to do, do what you would want to do.
Right.
And, you know, I feel very fortunate for those opportunities. And that's the best scenario is, you know, an owner that, that is passionate and has opinions and is helping get the most out of you and driving you to a shared vision. And then, you know, you let the people on the ground do their thing. And I've been, you know, again, fortunate to work with some really talented guys, you know, doing that out in the field. I'm here on a, building a par three course in the Dells, and these guys are fantastic. There's one of them standing outside the machine waiting for me to
well,
shut
you,
up.
You tell, so yeah, you tell him that you'll, yeah, you're on the Stick and Hack Show, and you'll be with him when you're damn well ready. Okay. Okay. Last question, Craig. I hear this advice all the time. Whatever course you play, when you're putting, they always say that the green breaks towards the water. Can we just stop doing that, please? Because it's annoying. Can you just stop doing those things, please? As a golf course designer, we don't need everything to break towards the water. It's stupid. Am I wrong?
Adam, I'm afraid these things will continue. And as long as gravity exists, that you're going to have to deal with this problem of things going towards you lower can,
physics are way over his head, Greg. Right. So,
but I agree that it's extremely annoying to play 18 holes with a guy who tells you this breaks to the mountain, this breaks to the to the valley.
Does it? Does it? Old. It's a 3-footer, Chief. Okay, it doesn't break
at
all.
Told you that wasn't gonna break as much. Right. Yeah, that guy is really annoying. Yeah. I try to not be that guy.
Right.
Not because I work on golf courses, but.
Have you ever said this breaks this way, and someone challenged you, and you go, "I built this course, Larry." Okay, I guarantee you,
I know where it's going.
Do not test me, fella.
Literally out here with a hand rake.
You would think I would have that confidence, but I have a extreme humility in my abilities to read putts, even if I built the green. So I just don't go there.
Well, Craig,
it is funny to see how confused people can get on a putting green.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
It
makes
Adam, you yourself.
Yeah. Okay. I get it. Yeah. I get it.
I can speak to that a little bit.
I can. Yeah. Thank you, Craig Haltom. He's a golf course designer, developer, and construction manager. You can find more information about him and his companies at craighaltom.com or elephantgolf.com. Craig, thank you so much for being a part of the Stick and Hack Show. Get back to work. Tell your boy outside the excavator that you have a job for him in a second. We appreciate your time and continued success as you literally shape the land of golf across the country.
Thanks, guys. Thanks a lot for having me.
All right, we'll talk to you later. Thanks, Craig. Thanks. All right, there he goes, Craig Haltom, craighaltom.com. We appreciate his time. That's a cool job. You don't think that that's you don't think about that at all as an actual position or a job, but he has a great passion for it. He has a great great mind, and the courses that he has designed and been a part of really are remarkable. Sand Valley is, if you're in the Midwest or anywhere, I guess you can fly places now. you can go to Sand Valley and play golf. It's unreal.
Yeah, that was
and
awesome.
Lasonia too. Lasonia is another one of his courses.
Yeah. That was really awesome. I just was an awesome conversation for me personally.
I knew it would be, and that's why I had him. I had him on the show for you, Mike. Yeah. All right, so this is our 10th episode, and we're inside the clubhouse now. I think it's about time that we learn a little bit more about each other, okay? So
I don't want to know anything about you.
Then you should probably leave.
I know too much now.
You should leave the show immediately because that's what's happening. Over the next few minutes, we're going to play a game called Simply the Best. Okay. It's not really a game. It's just facts. So I'm going to ask you questions. We're both going to answer what was the best whatever. Okay.
Okay.
So for you, Mike, this is rapid fire. There's no need to pontificate on it. We'll just go with the answers. Okay. What's the best thing about golf?
For me, being outdoors and then the relationships that you develop just playing golf and being around golf.
Awesome. For me, it's also the friendships that you get.
Yep.
Best type of playing partner?
A good one.
Okay.
That doesn't talk too much.
All right. So for me, a playing partner is somebody that's just a little bit better than me.
Okay.
I don't want somebody really good because it's frustrating. As a high handicapper, it's debilitatingly for mentally and also in some cases physically. I want somebody just a little bit better than me, but also can hit it off the hosel.
So are you blaming your shitty play on me? Is that what you're doing?
All right, next question. Best way to psych out a player? What's the best way to psych out a player during a match?
Oh. Typically to tell them what not to do.
Right. And then they do it.
Yeah.
Mine is just to...
It's like Jedi mind tricks.
Right. Mine's just to continually tell them every hole how terrible they are. Mm. And not just at golf, at life.
I'm sure that there's probably varying success there.
No, it's 100% depending success.
On, it's probably depends 100%. On handicap.
100% success.
Depends on
handicap. It's never failed me. That strategy has never failed me one time.
I don't believe you.
Well, that's fine. You're getting to know me. What's the best tip you've ever been given?
Best tip I've ever been given. I would probably say from the mental side of golf, it's always been to just approach one shot as its own entity and don't worry about what you did before or you're going to do in the next two holes, just be worried about what's happening in the present.
That's good. Yep. That's a good tip.
Yep.
You want to know mine?
Sure.
You should take up bowling.
That's way better than mine.
I know. And I didn't do that either. What's your best round ever? Score.
Score?
Yeah.
66.
Good night.
Yeah.
That is impressive. How many times have you shot that? 100
twice,
1,000,
two or three times, probably
40,000 every round.
No,
twice you've shot 66,
three times.
Okay, my best round ever, 79.
I know, I was there.
Yep, followed closely by my worst round. 79 is my best round ever.
Okay,
and I might have miscounted some strokes.
Okay,
what's the best thing about me? Okay. That's the Stick and Axe Show, everybody. That's going to shut it down. My thanks to Craig Haltom, craighaltom.com, golf course designer on the show. My thanks to Mike Ryan, just another stellar performance here in the Stick and Axe program.
Hey.
Go to Stick and... Oh, you have more?
Love you, buddy.
Thank you. Appreciate that. That would have been nice answers a second ago.
I stand by my answer.
Go to stickandaxe.com and become a member of the greatest golf club in the free world without the course. Read the Psych Factor... Mental Game of Golf, as well as a corner office, the fusion of golf and business, and of course, the Diary of a Hack, and a Stick Stance coming up here soon.
Yeah.
On Stick and Hack.
New
well.
One coming for
yeah.
me.
Yeah, we look forward to that. You guys have a great week, and we appreciate you coming to the Stick and Hack Show. Have a great week. See you.
Peace out, guys.
The Stick and Hack Show is now over. Subscribe, rate, comment, and tell your friends. You are now free to go about your day.